This episode of Green Space was recorded in November 2023. We were joined by Sean Webster. Sean Webster is a poet and graphic designer living in Minneapolis whose work attempts to put pressure on the spatial and temporal limitations of writing of the English language as a way to demonstrate its incapacity for describing blackness outside of a regime of death and dying. Webster's debut book, Gentrification, or the Scene of the Crime, was published by Noemi Press in 2018 and received the 2019 Minnesota Book Award. Sean Webster's latest book is Whale Song. Douglas Kearney writes of it, Sean Webster's dead-ass brilliant Whale Song is a counter-elegy not because nobody died, but because the body is a corpse. Webster retells us of the wholesale whale fall of retailed black bodies in the sea that, quote, died from which they did not emerge, and, quote, with steeled care Webster bears those who could not be buried, an arc of history bent towards us, moving through the pitching pitch, the deep blackness of his unfathomable imagination. It's a great book, and I hope you check it out. And I hope you enjoy this interview as much as we enjoyed talking to Sean. So without further ado, here's the interview. So Sean, even though these are troubled weeks on end, we're really glad to have you in Green Space. And I'm going to start with this question. What is the best thing that happened to you this week?
The best thing that happened to me this week was the release of Andre 3000's album, New Blue Sun. So, you know, I think I'm forming thoughts on the album, in terms of its musical contribution and quality, and am unresolved on some of those elements to the album. What I appreciate and I feel I am excited about by both the project, which I think of in larger terms than just its musical contributions, but what I think of as far as like the contributions of the project, in terms of artists, like in terms of the development and evolution of this artist, is something that I'm like really excited by. Like, I mean, there was an interview that Andre had back in 2019 where Andre was, I think it was interviewed by Rick Rubin. And like in that interview, like Andre 3000 was talking about just the way that they were having difficulty writing, that they were having no really real interest in doing vocal work, that it felt inauthentic to them. So I think when I look at this album as one that is without lyrics from an artist who we have come to understand as their artistic material being lyrics, to venture out into this thing that is to them at this point in their career, something that is a kind of unknown, right? I think that to me, those kinds of experiments excite me because, not because I think that they always produce the greatest quality of material, but they excite me because I think it is a kind of evidence of an arc in development that is dynamic, that has the possibility to move in a number of directions. And to that end, I think that a lot of the opposition that I've seen in folks' response to the album, to me, becomes really curious and oddly curious. I think that some of it is perhaps it's hard to separate for me what becomes folks' expectation of Black masculine performance, what folks see as the limit of that. I think there are things to be said about how folks want work that is legible, how folks desire work that is easily understandable and digestible. And that when it does not meet those particular kinds of expectations, that there ends up being a kind of disruptive norm or disruption of a norm that folks have said. And so I really appreciate that about the project. Not to mention the fact that like New Blue Sons, like, you know, makes me think both of Octavia's reference to there being other sons, but also it makes me think about the string of jazz musicians who have had a relationship to the color blue, whether you're talking about Sun Ra in Blue Universe or Miles Davis, and like just the relationship to blue in jazz music, which is not something that Andre has identified this project as, which I'll be clear about. And I don't know necessarily that I identify that as, but I think there is a kind of associative relationship and the referentiality to blue there that I appreciate as well. So I mean, that was a good thing that happened to me this week.
Yeah, it's amazing. They're really kind of, you know, incredible articulation of what it looks like for artists to venture out into these spaces that feel underexplored, or at least for them, right, feel like a real significant sort of shift. And as you're talking about this kind of venturing into the unknown, maybe even, you know, moving towards the illegible and pointing towards the future of various art forms, kind of leads nicely into this question that we've taken from Bernadette's list of journal ideas and writing experiments, which is, what is the poetry, writing, or medium of the future?
You know, that's a good question. I have this like really sordid relationship with poetry, and so like I find myself like writing things that are not readily understood to be poems. I find myself writing things right now that resist a lot of like what we tend to associate with the characteristics and craft of poetry. So I don't necessarily know that I can anticipate what a said like poetry of the future would look like. Part of me thinks that the poetry that I most identify with seeks the end of poetry. Part of me feels like the poetry that I most identify with seeks the end of genre and disciplinarity. And so I think a lot of what I am most interested by, that I think that poetry at its greatest potential offers me, is a space that leads itself into the end of poetry, that leads itself into the end of genre and disciplinarity. And so, and that's what I think that is to me the greatest promise that I gain from Black Studies, is that Black Studies, if we to take it seriously, would call for the end of disciplinarity. And so what does that mean for how we think about borders, whether they be material or epistemological, and how does that, you know, and what possibilities are there? Like, I find there to be a lot of possibility in that space, you know, though I find there to be a lot of unknown in that space. You know, like there, when you strip all of the material norms from what we come to understand as this contained and cohered thing, in this case, poetry, like, what do we have left after we strip it of those things? You know, maybe nothing. I don't know. But I'm interested. My projects are interested in that. Like, you know, and the poetry that I find myself gravitating towards is interested in that. So
Well, we certainly share that interest for art that's complicating those boundaries or bulldozing them or blurring them. And given your interest and pursuit of an art that is working against disciplinarity, this leads me to Mike Correo's question, which is, should art be useful, or what is useful? And I'm wondering if it has to do with that, with what you've just been describing, or if there's more to say about this.
Well, I mean, that's a good question. One, I think that poetry has been strapped with an incredible burden, an incredible theoretical burden that I don't think that fiction or nonfiction have to grapple with as a genre. Like, you know, like, and I think I've been thinking a lot about this actually. Like, I mean, like, but one, I don't know necessarily that I think that I have a personal desire to be useful, but I don't know necessarily that I want to believe that all art has to be useful. And I think that when we like utilize like use, that I think that we presuppose a kind of like relationship to value. And I want to resist like the norms of value. And so on some levels, like, I think that there are ways that some poetry, like when I think of the work of N.H. Pritchard, and when I think of like the kind of resistance that work had to meaning-making protocols, like, I think that a part of what we see as the reward from any literature is what it is that we gain from it in our ability to translate its meaning, right? And so when we enter into the space where meaning-making protocols are abandoned, right, then to us, a part of the reason why that becomes discomforting is because we can no longer rest on the norms that are established around what we see as one, like what is rewarding about literature, but also what's useful about it, right? It's useful because we can translate its meaning. It's useful because we can withdraw something meaningful from it, right? And what happens when, meaning is lost? What happens when the project is actually one where we're dealing with the Nakba or the Middle Passage? And as a result of the way that these traumas end up rupturing a kind of linear association with time, a event-based logic around like what we consider to be both a beginning and an end to what happened. There is no real clear beginning. There is no real end, right? So when we abandon like event-based logics, like, and when time doesn't become something useful to then become a marker for or a way to think about continuity or chronology, then you don't really have much meaning there. And in a lot of ways, that's a part of like what we've considered to be insanity, right? We consider madness to be a part of we consider madness to be when, like, you know, madness is often associated when we have no clear meaning that can be withdrawn from someone's speech patterns. So when someone's speech patterns do not show continuity and chronology, We consider there to be a connection around madness there. Like, we consider it to be madness when someone loses time. So when memory is lost in particular kinds of ways, there has been a long history of like an association with madness in that, right? And so all of that to say is that I am interested in work that might, like, I think that might flirt with or exist in a space of a kind of oppositionality to use, a refusal of use, right? Lyndon Barrett, cultural theorist, like, wrote about how, like, he has this book called Blackness and Value. And a part of what his argument is not just that Blackness, he says that Blackness is not devalued. He said Blackness exists outside of the terms of value. Like, it doesn't even register within the terms of value. And so I'm interested in what can happen within the space that exists outside of the registered terms of use and value. Like, I'm interested in what might be able to be made, if anything is to be made at all, what kind of politics can be had within that space. And so it can be a terrifying proposition, you know, on some levels, if we were to take it seriously. And I think that that's a part of, like, maybe what I appreciate about Afro-pessimism. And is that, like, you know, if we, that Jared Sexton articulates that it is a politics without demand, you know, which we would say is unuseful, right? But yeah, I don't know. I'm myself thinking these things through still, but think about them a lot.
Yeah, that makes me think of the article by American artists where they talk about in Black Gooey Universe, talking about the black screen and blackness and this sort of refusal through inoperability. And I think that there's something really incredible about the way we've moved through these ideas of the legible, continuity, meaning, like, cohesiveness, right? And also talking about music before makes me think of Dana Venable's question, what is noise, or what do you think of noise, right? And how might that interface with some of the things that we're talking about?
I think it interfaces really well, like, you know, like, because one, I think that there is a way that we make the distinction between noise and sound, right? That noise being something that is less cohered, right? Like, it is something that is, it is not legible in that way, right? And so I think of noise in the same way as I think of din, and din in the way that Edward Glissant talks about it in Caribbean Discourse. Because, you know, Edward Glissant says that din is discourse, right? And so then that din, this cacophonous thing, this thing that is in some ways inarticulable, right? That is itself a kind of, like, discourse. I'm always chasing that. Like, that's what, like, I'm chasing that inarticulable thing. I'm chasing that opaque thing that Glissant talks about, right? Like, that. So I'm like, I think that noise has a lot to do with what I'm trying to work out in my own work, and what I end up, at least, like, in some ways, like, reading through our understanding as a part of, you know, so much of the work that, like, I find interesting, like, you know. And so, you know, I'm interested in, like, and what noise means in relation to like even like that kind of inarticulability as a kind of articulation. Like I was raised in a Black Pentecostal church, right? Like, and so like I'm really, you know, I was raised in a space in which like the practice of speaking in tongues was something that was really regular. It was normative, right? Like, but that practice was something that is itself a practice that I look at one now, like, you know, in a similar way as like someone like Ashon Crawley and Black Pentecostal Breath, but like, I look at it as an aesthetic practice, right? And so like, as an aesthetic practice, I'm interested in what that practice was doing against logic and against a certain kind of terms around meaning making, right? And so it was articulation outside of meaning, right? And I'm like, I'm interested in what was like, what was being done there? Like what happens in the space of that articulation outside of meaning? And how do we think about that discursively, you know? I think that is a kind of like that was itself a kind of noise, right? Like that was a kind of noise, or folks could enter into a space like that, not having any kind of grounding around it, and consider that noise and useless, right? But I think that there's more happening there. Yeah,
that's so intriguing. The idea of these spaces where we speak with a voice that is ours and is also not ours, that we're touching like an outside voice as well. I mean, it's a totally, in many contexts, just a very different way to think about language and articulation. And while we're thinking about things that signify at the boundaries of legibility or that may be opaque, I want to move to talking about dreams and specifically Danica Stegman LeMay's question. Can you talk about what you do with dreams?
Wow. Like, I mean, dreams are like all up in my, like what I'm working on right now, you know? So I think of dreams as a kind of archival space. I think of dreams, one, like, you know, so I had, by the time I was two, I had no living grandparents. And so some of even my memories of my maternal grandmother, which I faintly had these, like I would have these reoccurring dreams, that I did not understand to be memories, but would tell my mother about them, like when I came, like when I was coming of age. And she was like, oh no, that happened. Like, you know, those are memories, right? And so to understand too, like what became inaccessible to me in my conscious mind, but accessible to me in that subconscious terrain of the dream, as a kind of archive, is a kind of powerful tool. I think of dreams also as something that's like, again, like I think that similar to these topics that we're having, like, right? Like, I think that there is something about dreams when we think about, there's something about dreams that disrupt narrative. There's something about dreams that disrupt the notion of narrative, like where we enter the dream in terms of temporally, like what, like, and that's my screaming 4-year-old right now. So like, if y'all hear that in the background, cause it's about that time, but, like where we enter the dream, like what concludes a dream, or if there is a kind of like clean conclusion to like a dream, there's no, like, I don't often have resolution in dreams. Like, I don't have a kind of sense of chronology in dreams. Like, I have a feeling of being dropped somewhere, like, and then ripped from that place, like, in waking. I think about this often because, like, you know, like my maternal grandfather was a porter, right? And a part of like the work of porters, one, like, you were restricted from sleeping, right? And so most of, like, and I didn't know him ever, didn't get to meet him, but most of the photographic record that I have of him, he was visibly very tired. Like, he was in between a space of awakeness and sleeping. And so I write a lot about that liminal space. And I'm interested in, like, what is possible to be produced there. Which is language I'm also not committed to, because it's like, again, like, I'm like, you know, so yeah, I'm like, the dreams are something I'm very interested in. And I'm still like, you know, I'm early in my thinking around dreams and like and thinking of dreams too in relationship to photography. And to film. And to the jump cut in film, like, and like to like, so I'm like, there are all these things that are like, I'm exploring around like what we think about sequence, like exploring in terms of how I think about the terms of narrative and historiography. And so, yeah, like, yeah, I'm really fascinated by dreams.
That's great. I was actually planning on leading us into a direction that was going to build off of the brief mention you had of the photo. So coming back to that at the end of your answer there was really incredible. So we have, as you were saying, in the dream space, this kind of space where memory becomes accessible in different ways or new ways. And then when we start to also embed that in things like photographs, and also as you're talking about the jump cut, right, there's this type of like tactility and construction of memories and constructions of history through that, which kind of makes me think about the various objects that circulate in and out of our lives that also can kind of carry some of this weight within it. And this comes from Jay Bessemer. This question is, what is an object that has had a powerful meaning in your life?
That's great. Like, I mean, one of the objects that I've spent a lot of time with, one of the objects that I spent a great deal of time with has been like this, and I've written about, has been this wallet that has been passed to me from my mom. That was my maternal grandfather's. And so it's this way of trying to think about, you know, haptic relationships, like, you know, through touch, what kind of knowledge and ways that knowledge is accessible. What's up, baby? Sorry, I'm gonna have to wind down here in a minute, but yeah, like, I think that it becomes ways for me to think about a kind of loss, that the wallet is empty, that my maternal grandfather was poor and was poor by design. It makes me think about labor. And so, I mean, there are any number of things that object holds so much translated meaning for me around, and that I've tried to just kind of sit with as a way to try to access other ways of knowing. But yeah. To the mention of like the photograph, like, I think that the photograph and memory and those sorts of pieces, I also think about those things in relationship to how one, like, those are always speculative acts, right? Like the imagination, memory, like how we kind of are retelling ourselves of those things that have happened are acts that are speculative. And so I think that part of me is trying to become more comfortable with that. I'm actually writing a work of speculative nonfiction. And so,
yeah, well, I'm going to look forward to all of these works that sound like they're germinating in relation to speculation and dreams. They sound absolutely fascinating. And since we're talking about nighttime and it being about that time, I'll move to Allison Carden's question, something of an enigmatic question. Sean, what's up with the moon?
What's up with the moon? Well, I think that this might have to be my final answer, but in terms of the moon, there was somebody actually that was talking today about the moon in this this panel that I went to, and I forget the name that they were giving to it, but it was like the name of like the part of the moon that was a part of its darkest shadows. And so it was just like this really interesting conceptual thing, and like how we think about illumination and darkness and knowledge and so. I don't often think about the moon. Funnily, my oldest child, who's 14 now, used to call the sun and the moon Namanu and Gabagoo. And so had these like, and I was like interested in how like kids actually engage in that kind of like practice of speaking in tongues, this kind of glossolalic thing where they're often giving names and sound to things differently than we might have access to. So yeah. That might be what's up with the moon.